you know, as law enforcement officers, we have to know Miranda and Terry v. Ohio and, you know, due process, Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. We're very, very focused on making sure our officers don't violate suspects' rights. And it's rare that there is a large focus on victim-focused policing. 111, 110. Welcome back to the Street Cop Podcast. I am Heather Glogalich, the instructor for the Complete Female Cop here at Street Cop Training. And today, Eric Baum is going to be here and attempting to interview me, I guess, right? Isn't that what we talked about yesterday?
An attempt is always a good thing, yes.
Yeah.
And my name is Eric Baum. I'm the instructor for effective interview and interrogation techniques that work for all law enforcement. For Street Cop Training, and it's a pleasure to be back here for what will be my second podcast, and especially a pleasure to be able to sitting across from Heather, the complete female cop, who is more than just a colleague. She has become a true friend, and it's an honor to be able to sit here across from you.
Oh, you're
and,
cute.
And I say that because I want the audience to know that I came down to your training class that you had here, and I had told you in advance that I wasn't going to be able to stay for the entire duration. You know, being retired, I had a lot to do, like golfing and smoking cigars and so on and so forth. But staying for the first hour and listening to you speak about your life and what you've endured and where you have achieved in your life and career, I told you that I was just amazed.
Thank you.
And I mean it. And I don't, and you know, for the audience to know, I don't say shit just to say it.
Yeah.
I say it because I mean it. And it's an honor to be here. And like I said, we had spoken after the Nashville conference about getting together and doing a podcast because you felt that after watching my 1 hour block speaking about interviewing and interviewing victims of crimes, and you actually mentioned it in your presentation and said you should really have paid attention to the way Eric Baum talked about what he said with victims. And I said, thank you very much, obviously, and it meant a lot to me. And we agreed to do this and talk about this because you have something obviously very in common with victims. Mm-hmm. And without getting into your entire story, which if people want to know what your entire story is, I mean, I would suggest that they attend your class or watch your on demand, because it is probably one of the most powerful presentations that anyone can watch. And I'm going to stress to everybody, it is not just for female cops.
Yeah.
It's not just for female cops.
Yeah. And even at the conference, I think I was so blown away by the amount of men that came up to me in Nashville. And I'm sure that there are people that feel that that was an easy thing for me to do. And I appeared comfortable up there, but I was really nervous to get up on a stage in front of probably mostly 1500 men and just be the only girl of Street Cop to do that, right? I mean, I know we have had Tommy Lahren and she was a female on that stage, but that's what she does. And I think my credibility was something I was worried about, because I felt guys were maybe not even going to show up because they knew it was me teaching it and it wasn't anything female related at all, right? It wasn't gender specific for the conference. I did that on purpose. But a lot of them came up to me and they're like, we learned so much from you. And we loved getting to hear you, and we almost didn't show up and we're sorry. And one of the things that they said to me was, we would love to attend your class, but we don't want to be in the room and make women feel that they can't talk about the things that they want to talk about comfortably, which I really had never thought about. And that was a really great perspective. But also they said, I work with women and I wouldn't want to take their spot from being able to be there. So yes, while men are more than welcome, I can understand why they don't feel like they should be coming.
So that's interesting, because there is a probably just a preconceived notion in men's minds about that feeling. And you actually said something that's quite interesting. Having worked with female victims for so many years in my career, men may not understand this, but certain victims of sexual assault crimes, mm-hmm. which is what I did for the majority of my career, they actually felt more comfortable talking to me as a male detective rather than a female. This is adults, as a female detective, and I started to try to delve a little into why that was. And sometimes they felt like a female police officer would perceive them in a different way rather than a male who had the right approach to do it. But before we even delve into that, just a little bit of a background about you, Heather. How long have you been a police officer now?
About 19 and a half years.
Okay. And I know you started in a corrections capacity.
I started with the sheriff's office, but
office, but not corrections.
What they call upfront. So I was a certified police officer.
Okay. And transferred eventually to?
A year and a half later to Morris Township.
Okay. And you've been with Morris and a half Township now for 17 plus years.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I wanted to ask you, knowing about your background and what you had to endure and what you still, I'm sure, emotionally and mentally still endure on a daily basis, me knowing, not experiencing, but knowing what survivors, and you were a survivor, and what victims deal with on a daily basis. Your encounters that you had with your domestic situation began while you were a police officer?
Yeah.
Okay, so you were in law enforcement and you encountered this domestic, how would you describe it? Abuse scenario? I mean,
I mean, the relationship was just so toxic, both, not just both, but emotionally, physically, financially, sexually. I mean, not up until about 2 years ago, I didn't really start talking about the fact that I was sexually assaulted by my ex-husband either, right? Because everybody knew I was a DV survivor, and I was okay being that. But to open up and really admit to also being sexually assaulted by him was something I didn't want to be. Like, I didn't want that label either. And most people wouldn't believe me because we were married and there was that expectation.
Of course.
So I think that's one of the biggest barriers when it comes to domestic violence is that, especially in New Jersey, and talking New Jersey-based, you know how it is. If sexual assault victims don't want to move forward with charges, you're done. However, there's a little bit of a caveat with the mandatory arrest with New Jersey with domestic violence when it falls underneath that scenario. So it's been a balance. And I finally, a couple of years ago, realized that I don't need to worry about how other people see me, and I don't need to be defined by anything. And I thought it would be more powerful to speak the truth about it, and that sexual assault isn't always something that's violent, and it isn't with strangers most of the time. It's with people that you know.
That is a fact.
That if you're doing it in order to placate somebody else so you don't get hurt or screamed at, that's not consensual sex. And so, you know, he was never charged with anything like that, but I've been empowered by being able to be open and honest about that.
I think it's wonderful. And the fact that you're even being able to talk about it is more power to you, because not many people are capable of expressing what they've encountered and what they've endured, which leads me into what I wanted to ask you. How long would you say you went through what you were going through with your husband in terms of a duration before it finally came to a head in the conclusion where you and him no longer had anything to do with one another? How long would you say that lasted?
Oh, boy. So that is a layered question. Because we met in the police academy January of 2004.
And you're going to see how it segues into what I'm going to ask you.
Understood. So he was on his best behavior till we got married, for real. And there was the controlling aspects of our relationship where he would say, oh, I wouldn't answer the phone, and he would show up at work and be like, oh, I just missed you. But really, it was him checking up on me. You don't have to go to the gym. Like, who else are you trying to look good for? And I'm like, oh, I'm a cop. Like, I want to be in shape. And there were these little manipulative things and controlling things that he did that I didn't really even realize, because I never grew up in a relationship like that. Like, my parents are amazing, right? They're still married. It's like 45 years later. They barely ever argue with each other. And love never hurt in my family. So it wasn't anything that I've been used to. Felt I probably should have known better, but once we got married, it was whenever I wasn't pregnant, it was physical. But I was pregnant. We were only married. We got married in March of 2006 and we separated in October of 2008. And I had two babies during that time. So we really, it wasn't physical as much as everybody thinks. And it escalated very quickly. I mean, less than on one hand were there times that he got physical with me in any manner, even just pushing or whatever. And I'm not talking about the non-consensual sex that I had with him, because a lot of that was him like drunk and yelling at me and then me trying to placate it. But it wasn't like, you know, he had strangled me like he had a couple times, or the one event where it all ended the relationship. But I think what people don't understand, especially police officers, which is something that I really love to talk about, is when somebody calls 911 or comes in and asks for help as a victim, they want to feel safe in that moment. And they don't want to relive past trauma if they don't have to, because they're re-victimizing themselves and they want to be done, right? They just want to be done. They want to tell their story and they want us to take care of it. And some of them will be like, I want to see this through the end, but most of them just want to move forward. They don't want to be that person anymore. And so with my ex-husband, we had two kids together. So he used the criminal justice system against me because he was no longer a cop and he knew how it worked. Domestic violence court, just the divorce, parenting, co-parenting. Him calling DCPMP if there was a bruise on one of my kids from sports. It was an effect.
So people understand that they're out. So people understand what outside of the state, what Heather was referring to is what we would call child protective services.
Yes. Yeah. So it's CPS some places. It used to be DIFAS, DCPMP now, Division of Child Protection and everything. But, and up until, literally up until he killed himself in December, I've had to deal with the abuse of him. And one of the other things I've really started to talk about, is there are little ways of re-victimization that nobody will ever understand. So even if I would get a direct deposit of child support and I would see that come up, it would trigger something in my mind. And it would, not every time, but I started to notice a pattern of, man, now I have to think about him because it equates it. And I would just love to just not think about him anymore.
So at number of years, 10?
Well, I mean, it's going to be 15 years that he and I are separated. So probably 18 years of abuse.
So I think what the benefit of our dialogue back and forth is that when you teach your class, you are the primary speaker.
Yeah.
And I would say 99% of the audience is listening and digesting what you're saying and probably have questions. And maybe during the breaks, they'll come up and they'll ask you, or maybe they'll come up and share something with you.
Yeah.
And this gives an opportunity for those that may not have asked any questions to maybe hear certain questions that may be in their mind that they never got to ask to you. But secondly, this is what segues into what I wanted to ask you. Becoming a victim, and and so the audience understands, it's irrelevant of what type of victim we're talking about.
Yeah.
Assault, abuse, I mean, whatever. Like you said, he was stealing from you.
Yeah.
So you were being victimized in a multitude of ways. As a law enforcement officer, when you were going through what you were going through and then having to go into work on a daily basis, did your perceptions of having to deal with other victims that you obviously on a daily basis had to encounter, did it change in some way? Were you more reflective on your attitude towards victims? Maybe more resentful, more compassionate, showing more empathy, sympathy? Just curious, did you have any change knowing what you were going through and then encountering victims that may have been going through the same thing?
So
I don't know if you've ever been asked that question.
I haven't ever been asked that question. And I think most people ask me, how do I respond when I go to domestics, and do I get angry at the suspect? Right. And if I act differently, right, then that's usually the question.
Yeah,
I get.
That would make sense.
I became much more of a victim focused investigator, I think. You know, as law enforcement officers, we have to know Miranda and Terry v. Ohio and, you know, due process, Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. We're very, very focused on making sure our officers don't violate suspects' rights. And it's rare that there is a large focus on victim-focused policing. And I brought something new to the table. And I wasn't allowed to talk about it until my ex-husband was convicted, because he could have come after me for hearsay and all those things. So I wasn't really allowed to publicly talk about it. But I remember the exact case where it, the way I approached people and the way I policed changed, because I felt I had to fit a mold and a box, and I had to be a little bit more standoffish or stoic as a police officer. Like, there's this professionalism that's preached to us as far as not crossing lines. And the most vulnerable aspect of our job is when we interact with victims, and it should be. And humanity was never a part of policing like it is now, which I love. It's really evolved. So for me, the way it changed was I realized that I could discuss who I was personally in a professional setting, and it was okay, and that they weren't allowed to tell me I couldn't if it helped somebody. So there was this victim that came in, and it wasn't my case, and she was just beat to hell, and like, she couldn't open her eye. I felt really bad for her. And I'm sitting across the table from her because I now had a vested interest, because I saw what happened, and she was being very evasive in her answers. And I knew that what she was saying was the things that I said in order to protect myself from people knowing what was going on. And I sat across from her. I go, "We're here to protect you, and you can say anything that you need to, and we will help you." And she's like, "You have no idea what I'm going through." And I was like, "Well, why do you assume that?" And she goes, "Because you're this confident, strong cop. Like, you would never be in the situation I'm in." I'm like, "Well, girl, let's have a talk, right?" And I told her what happened to me, and she just broke down crying. She told us everything she needed to, she wanted to do. She was able to relate to me. And I think what I brought to the table for her was I was able to say to her that this is not going to be easy, and it's your choice how you move forward, but this is going to be a really long process. And I know how it is. Most cops don't. They don't see that other side of victims having to worry about going to domestic violence court in New Jersey within 10 days and sitting on this one side. And before COVID, it was like all the victims on one side and all the aggressors on the other. And most of the time it's women that are reporting it. And so there was all these women, and within 10 days, you had to stand up and say, "Yes, I want to go through with a restraining order," or "No, we can drop it." And then the court system gives it back, the power back to the suspect or the defendant, and says, "Okay, are you all right with that? Or do you want to fight her or him in court legally with the justice system to say, no, you don't think you deserve a final restraining order?" There's these little things. And, you know, we have crisis response team members that'll come out. We have volunteers and we have victim advocates. I don't know that all victim advocates have been victims. So I don't know if they're the best person. So I really took that ownership onto myself as a police officer to allow them to understand the whole process from start to finish, from reporting to when it might be done. And then the little ways they won't even know that they're going to be re-victimized.
I think that's excellent, because that is a great response of what I was trying to get to. And, you know, the flip side to that is, had you not been subjected to what you were subjected to in your life, do you still think that you would have treated that victim the same way? Would you have been more like, "All right, if you don't want to talk about it, then..."
No, I think the way that I approach people has always been the same. I believe I've always been somebody who was heart-led, but I wouldn't have been as impactful.
Well, I think that's irrelevant. I mean, I think that's relevant. And not all law enforcement officers understand the impact that their first encounters with victims have on the victims. And when I instruct my class, Heather, I touch upon something very, very simple. I said, you as a responding law enforcement officer to a victim-related crime, I don't care what the crime is, there's a victim and there's a crime, and you're going to have an encounter with a victim to start the entire judicial process. Your first encounter dictates everything that victim perceives is going to happen. Because remember, the majority of the population do not have encounters with police. They just don't. Maybe they got pulled over. maybe they know somebody that's a friend of a cop and so on and so forth. But the majority of people in our society don't have encounters with police. And the only encounters that they have is what they see on TV and those perceptions. So when you, as the first responding officer, meet that victim, especially somebody who may have been victimized in an assaultive way and physically hurt in some way, emotionally hurt in some way, your first interaction dictates what they feel is going to happen to them throughout their entire dealings with the justice system. And then I follow it up. And you as a New Jersey law enforcement officer and me as a retired New Jersey law enforcement officer, if the case results in the arrest of somebody, how long does it take before that case is ever adjudicated in court? Give me your average.
Pre-bail reform or post?
Let's just go post.
Nobody's going to understand that unless you're from Jersey.
I mean, listen, how long does it take before you get the subpoena to testify in grand jury?
Oh, a long time. Well, I mean, I guess it depends.
Could be 3 months.
Oh, minimum.
Six months?
It was.
Yeah.
It was my ex-husband's grand jury indictment. It happened in October and he was in the summer of the following year that he went in for grand jury. So, and that's really frustrating because it's you keep getting these court notices and it just keeps feeling like it's never going to end.
And think of that, how you feel mentally. So that law enforcement officer's first encounter is so important to explaining to that victim, this is not like television. That's what I used to say. I go, I want you to understand this is not like television. I go, and I would ask people, have you ever watched the show Law and Order? And they'd be like, yeah, I've heard of it. I go, okay. I go, if you saw the show Law and Order, the first 30 minutes is what? The investigation. The next 30 minutes is the court proceedings. I go, so it's over in 1 hour. I go, that's TV.
Yeah.
This could take up to a year before it is ever resolved. And that's why it is so important that that first law enforcement officer's encounter with that victim is done right and it's done properly. Because I have personally seen where cases have gone, I'll say it, right down the shitter.
Yeah.
Strictly because of a law enforcement officer's response. And having worked in sex crimes and child abuse for so many years, I'm never the first to respond. I'm never the first to respond. You know who's the first to respond to an allegation of a sexual assault or a child sexual assault? Law enforcement. Yeah. Because that's where the first call, unless it is something that is brought in because somebody came in months later, weeks later, years later to report the abuse, that, you know, little different. But normally, 9 out of 10 times, it's a law enforcement officer. And if that law enforcement officer's first interaction makes that victim say, why did I even call?
Yeah.
We're done. So that's why I stress the importance of this in my class and why I know that you took something from it and said, wow, it's pretty impactful.
It is.
And you're uniformed law enforcement.
I am.
You know, and I was never in uniform. You know, my career was always starting in plain clothes and then, you know, suit and ties. I understand physical appearance is important to us in law enforcement, especially patrol officers, because you now do something that you love to do, which is what? Tell the audience.
Jiu-jitsu.
And you do it for a multitude of reasons, I'm sure.
I do.
Just like a lot of cops go to the gym and lift and lift and lift. Believe it or not, I used to be a pretty heavy weightlifter in my day, but now I'm an older man, so I can't do it, but I used to. But I always had that feeling when I was working street crimes or narcotics and things like that, that I wanted to have a physical presence that if it intimidated a bad guy for a second to think about, you're going to come at me? I'm ready.
Yeah.
And that physical could be like, all right, you know what? Can I take this guy or not? Can I outrun him or not? We know that's what happens in a heartbeat. So I understand that that physical appearance is so important and looking tough and expressing it. That's not what it's all about. I mean, I'm sure I did a little lecture for you.
You did.
And I saw some of the law enforcement officers in your department.
Yeah.
And some of them were goddamn pretty good shape.
Actually, our agency right now, I mean, they're all really good shape.
Good shape. And you know what? Physically intimidating by appearance. Not in the worst way, but you know what I mean? Like,
they have a good officer presence.
A good officer presence.
Yeah.
But my point being is that the physical appearance has to have a flip side to that.
Yes, it does. And I really, we talk about these gender specific roles, especially in my class. And, you know, one of the best sex crimes detectives I've ever met is Carolina Moreno. I think you know who she is. She now works in a different prosecutor's office. I've learned so much from her, even as somebody who survived being a victim. Like, she's taught me how to be even a better investigator when it comes to victims of crimes. But the one thing I've really always taken from her is that she taught me that just because I'm a woman does not mean that I should be always the one interviewing female victims at all, because
that's absolutely correct.
There is nothing more empowering to a woman who is a victim of a crime than having a strong but sensitive man sit across from her and say, "You don't deserve this at all."
Exactly what I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, it's so impactful, but it has to be genuine when they say it. And our words matter. That's really what it comes down to. I think we're so worried about, you know, not saying the right thing to suspects so we can keep that, but we don't realize the impact we have with the little things that we say with victims. So you respond to a domestic, and one of your questions has to be, "So what happened today?" Right? Why not lead with, I'm not judging you at all. I am here to help in any situation or in any capacity that I can. But I'm going to have to ask you some questions that are going to be hard. And I don't want you to think that they're coming from a place other than me just trying to find out what happened. This should not have happened to you, but I need to know what led to today." Right? Saying it that way, instead of walking in and be like, "Huh, what happened? What would you do before that made him hit you? Or what would you do before that made her like want to stab you with a knife?" Right? That places blame on the victim, and they've been blamed enough.
So victim blaming is horrific, obviously. And I like that approach. And I think it's important. I think that the audience that's watching, law enforcement officers that respond to those types of crimes, I would ask, how hard is it? How hard is it when you first encounter a victim who's been assaulted in some way, even, again, any other type of victim, but assaulted in some way? How hard is it for your first words to be, "I'm sorry for what happened to you. Is there anything that I could do for you right now to make you feel more comfortable as we're going to proceed?" And obviously, the first thing and foremost, is if the person requires medical attention, we're going to get the medical attention done. But it's good, because what you just said leads me into something that I used to teach. I still teach it, but you know, I now expand upon it. But years and years ago, yep, that's how old I am. There was something that I learned, and it stuck with me. It was called the you, we, I approach to victims. People say, "All right, what's the you, we, I approach?" The you, we, I approach can be used in any situation involving a law enforcement officer and a victim. And it's so simple, Heather. It's so simple. First encounter. Who was it about? You. You're the victim. "I'm sorry to meet you under these circumstances. I know this is difficult. Is there anything I could do for you right now as we're going to proceed?" Then becomes the we phase. "We are going to be working together as a team as we move forward with this." And then the I phase, which is me explaining to the person, "This is my information gathering phase where I'm going to be doing the initial parts of this investigation. You, about you first, then it's about we working together, And then it's about what I need to achieve this. Pretty simple.
Very simple.
So something that I would stress, I would hope that from our dialogue here that officers that respond to crimes, no matter, again, what the crime is that if they could just take a deep breath before they encounter that victim, it doesn't matter who the victim is.
Yeah.
You know that criminals can be victims, right?
Yeah.
But does that mean we're supposed to treat them differently?
No, and I love that you said that because when you think about who gets victimized, people that try to victimize people are going to find people that are weaker than them or that won't be as believed, right? They pick the girl with the short skirt that's too drunk at a party because no one's going to believe her because she was too intoxicated or she was underage, so she might not come forward. They're going to pick the spouse that has mental health issues because nobody's going to believe them when it's unbelievable. Or they're going to pick the drug addict. They're going to pick a prostitute. They're going to do or commit these crimes on people that are easy to continue to victim shame and blame, and then also make them non-believable, right? Use that gaslighting technique all the time. So I love that you brought that up because Dennis actually said it one time, and it was really impactful to me because he talked about a girl that he arrested numerous times for heroin. And she said something very simple, and she goes, "Would it make a difference to you if you knew that I didn't choose this, that an ex-boyfriend of mine shot me up and I've been addicted ever since?" Right? So becoming a victim of a crime is not a choice. Whether or not you stay, sometimes people think it's a choice and it's not, but how you react and move forward is a choice. And you can either remain a victim with a victim mindset or you can change it. And that's where the focus or the refocus of my life came from. And if I'm being very transparent, I don't even feel like I'm that person anymore.
Let me ask you though, this is a good segue into something about law enforcement understanding why victims don't come forward, especially with sexual assault and domestic. There is a wide range of emotions when a victim is victimized in that capacity that prevents them from proceeding forward. What were some of the feelings that you, these are all feelings that I'm going to be very familiar with of having heard them 1,000 times, but let's hear them from you. What prevented you? And I want you to bypass that you had family. I want you emotionally.
Yeah.
What you were feeling, what prevented you from the day one picking up the phone?
So on a personal level, and this is something I've only come to realize within the past year or two, I think I believed that he could be better because I was better.
Okay.
Right? So I knew that I could love somebody the right way. So I didn't understand why he couldn't. And I couldn't fathom doing what he did. So to me, it wasn't something that was normal. I was embarrassed. I was nervous about what everybody else was going to think about me. I was worried I wouldn't be believed because I hadn't come forward sooner. And I had no idea what the future would hold. And I can't really take the family part out of it because when I finally called 911, I had a 20-month-old and an 8-month-old. And I was worried about being at the lowest salary point, how I was going to survive, how I was going to have.
And that's important with respect to the family. Yes.
Yeah. So that kept me there because you worry about whether or not you're overreacting. You know, you see things and you wonder whether or not they're true. You know, with my ex-husband, he was very much somebody who, when he and I would have a conversation, if he was intoxicated, which was a lot, no matter what I said was not true. And so it got to the point where I had to start lying or saying the lies he wanted to hear, but then he would switch it up. And it was a whole lot of me not really trusting what was going on in my own head. And I didn't trust myself to get through it. I had been broken down. No matter what, a victim is going to find something that they did that should be their fault on why it happened. It doesn't matter what. It could be a homeowner whose house was broken into and they'll be like, oh, maybe I should have had a dog. Maybe I should have gotten that system. Maybe I shouldn't have left the door unlocked. But on the personal level of victimization, we always wonder whether or not we should have left earlier or we should have seen that sign or maybe we shouldn't have pushed that button or maybe we shouldn't have worn those clothes or drank that much. you know, for me, the guilt was that I had two kids with this person, that I wasn't married very long. I was nervous that the guys at work weren't going to think that I could handle my stuff at work because I couldn't handle it at home. And there was no prior history. And he was, I thought, beloved. He was officer of the year. He was a great cop. You know, his father was a chief of police. So I was worried about that also, and whether or not he was going to have power over it. And when I came forward, he hired a private investigator to follow me around, his father, my ex-father-in-law, which again, just re-victimized me. It was like, what am I doing wrong that I deserve this? And nobody deserves it at all, but we're always going to punish ourselves. Like, I still to this day punish myself for allowing it to get as far as it did at times. And I've done a lot of self-growth and a lot of mindset changing. But when I see like my kids struggle with things, or like with my son last year being beat by my ex-husband, I wonder whether or not I should have pushed harder in family court, or whether or not I shouldn't have cared so much about maintaining my job because I was bound by, you know, civil orders that most people aren't, because they're not sworn law enforcement officers. And you wonder all about the what ifs. And I really had to learn to let go of that, because I can't change what's done. And so I just constantly, every single moment of my life, always in everything that I do, wonder how I can do better and be better.
That's very important that you, what you said, that it's very easy to be reflective backwards.
Yeah. Hindsight's 20/20.
Rather than looking forward to the future, and what could be done, as you're saying, you're living your life now thinking forward, not backwards. And the reason I asked that question about what your feelings were is, and you hit every single one that I knew as a result of working with victims for so many years, which is fear, shame, embarrassment, guilt. What will the future bring? I'm still in love. All reasons that I could never understand from the victim's perspective, but need to understand what the word empathy is have the same feelings as seen through the subject's eyes. That's not sympathy, it's empathy. And saying, what is this person feeling? And that's what I used to hear. Well, this is what's going to be asked of you as this case proceeds. And you need to be prepared ahead of time, because what I would say is I do not want you to come back later and say, Eric, how come you didn't fucking warn me that this is what I was going to go through? So everything that I'm doing is to prepare you in advance for what is going to happen. Why you didn't report it right away. Why you allowed it to continue. A, B, C. All these things is what a defense attorney is going to try to use to destroy your credibility.
Yeah.
But if we could get up and out front in advance, then they have nothing. And the most important thing that I would share with every victim, Heather, the most important thing I would say is, I'm looking for one thing from you only one thing. That is, I want you to tell me what?
The truth.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I would say it. If you're telling me the truth, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
And telling a victim that that's all I'm seeking is the truth, it doesn't make it that much difficult. It's like, okay, that's not difficult.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well.
Listen, if sex crimes detectives can sit across from some of the most heinous offenders and make them feel okay about speaking their truth, we should be able to do the same with victims.
Oh, I concur. I concur.
And two things I want to mention to just piggyback off of what you said. When I talk about words mattering, or that words matter, it's important for police officers to understand that it's okay to say all the things that make a victim understand that it's okay to feel them. So without making them say it, because at the time they come forward, they might not be able to articulate that they're scared or uncertain or whatever. So having someone say, hey, listen, right now you probably feel like I'm judging you or that I don't want to be here or that you're a waste of my time. I just want you to know that's not the case. Like, I'm dedicated to you right now and making sure that you're safe, whatever that looks like for you. When you put that on the table so they don't have to articulate it, or they can be like, oh my gosh, it's okay that I feel this way. I don't even know if I was feeling this way, but that really just, the walls come down. And second, I really wish there was, I'm going to plug an app right now. It's called Victim's Voice. And it's one word, two capital V's, Victim's Voice, all one word. And it's a web-based app. And this woman, Sherry Kurtical, came up with it. And I wish I had known about it when I was going through what I went through. And I'm very fortunate to volunteer as a law enforcement advisor for it, because there were some aspects of it that she didn't really understand from our perspective. But what it does is it allows, there's this Dauber standard when it comes to testimony. And it allows for that, right? So hearsay is a very big thing. And I know we have a national audience, so this may not work necessarily in every single state, because in New Jersey, it's only a one-party state for recording. So you can't record like video or audio or anything. But one of my biggest setbacks and why my ex-husband only had to take a plea deal for 6 months, he was facing kidnapping charges, you know, possession of a gun, possession of a knife, you know, criminal restraint, terroristic threats, unlawful possession of a weapon, all these things, right? Like up to like 70 years in jail or prison is what I was like hoping for. And he took a plea deal for 6 months and he did 2 months and 1 week in jail because there was no prior reporting history, right? So I only came forward when I knew that if I didn't, I wouldn't be able to call 911 because the next time I would be dead, right? This app allows a victim to go in and document what's going on. And you can designate a certain person, you can designate a police department. So if something happens to you and you're in a coma or you're killed, that person can hand it in and it meets all the requirements of the Dauber Standard of Admissibility in court. And it's huge. It's a small monthly payment, yearly payment. I think it's like $39 for it. It's all web-based. If you have Apple, you're not going to be able to use it on an app because Apple wanted partial rights to it, which would give up confidentiality of victims. And
no,
Sherry
that
refused.
Can't be done.
So you can do a web-based app. There's no trace of it. You can't go back in and edit anything. It watches your keystrokes. So if you go onto the one page and it says, or one of the prompts and it says, how are you abused? And you can pick like financial, sexual, physical, emotional, like you can pick those and you click sexual and you unclick sexual, it meets the standard so much that when it gets printed out, a detective will be able to see that you unclicked sexual and can come in and be like, you unclicked this. Is there anything you want to talk to me about? It's just, it's brilliant and it's wonderful. And you just, you use it if you want to, but you don't have to. So when you're ready to come forward, here is all this.
That's a great thing where technology presents itself in a unique way.
Because people get mad at victims for not coming forward earlier, whether they want to admit it or they don't. But you're not going to get a victim to come forward until they feel like they can't help themselves anymore. Or until they feel like they're at the point where they don't know what else to do and they need to be safe.
Sit. I'm just going to grab something.
Okay.
I want to share this with you and I want to share it with our audience here. And this is not about me and backpatting, which is, it's not important for me to do. And then I'm going to follow up with something with you that I think is extremely important to talk about. So the audience doesn't really know us unless they've worked with us.
Right.
So they don't know what we've done in our careers with respect to successes we had. And I don't have to justify to anybody what I've done. I've put a lot of bad people behind bars as a result of what I've learned to do, especially when it comes to interrogation. And I was also out on the streets. I mean, I worked narcotics, I worked street crimes, I worked fugitives in a prosecutor's office. You know, you could be assigned to different units at different times, but the majority of my career was working sex crimes and child abuse and working with victims. People would ask me, what was the greatest satisfaction that, you know, you received in this job, you know, putting away child pedophiles, sex offenders, getting a murder suspect to confess when nobody else could, you know, what's the greatest arrests,
yeah,
armed robberies, you know, things like that. And I used to sit back and I would think about it, like, what was the most fulfilling thing that happened with me in my career?
Such a buildup. I'm so excited, right?
No, but this is how simplistic it is in terms of my mindset. Rather than reading, Heather, the top line in black, read underneath the top line in black first, and then read the top line in black.
Okay. You want to read it out loud?
Yeah, read it out loud. And I want people to understand what meant so much to me.
I'm allowed to put the person's name out there that's written on here?
You can put the name out there. Yeah, well, I want you to read the before the top black line.
I know, but there's a name here. I'm allowed to say that AP's name. Okay. Dear Ken Ralph, Assistant Prosecutor, thank you so very much for your hard work in this case. We are very pleased with the outcome. Also, thank you to all that were involved with Lisa, especially Eric. He was so kind, understanding, and patient. He related to her and made it easy for her to tell about it.
Who was Lisa?
Lisa was a sexual assault victim with Down syndrome, and the family is the one that wrote this.
Yeah, you could put that down there. So when the assistant prosecutor shared that letter with me, this was a young girl with Down's syndrome. And I mean, she was a young girl who was sexually abused by the driver of the bus that would take her to the special ed school. I mean, when I talk about Down syndrome, I'm talking full physical characteristics of Down syndrome. And it was my case. I met with Lisa. I spoke to Lisa. She was able to communicate enough with me for me to initiate what I did, and ultimately resulted in me getting the confession from the driver, what he did, and it resolved itself. That right there, Heather, is what it was all about for me. That right there. So that's why I wanted people to understand, like, wow, this guy is pretty passionate about victims. Nothing is more better than that. Just like when you have victims reach back out for you, which I'm sure has happened after the fact, and said, thank you.
Yeah, you know, I think the most rewarding ones are the ones that don't ever get physical, where I step in or I show up. And I do believe that we are brought together with people for a reason, good and bad, right? We can learn something from everyone. And, you know, there's this one person from my town who, she was dealing with somebody who was an alcoholic and father of her kids. And we went there a couple times, and some of the things that he admitted to saying, I knew were abusive. And because she had never been hit, she didn't think that she was an abuse victim. And I'm not the kind of person that who's going to make something out of nothing. But I sat her down and I was like, I think you need to realize that you deserve to not feel this way in your relationship. And that if you're doubting who you are, or you're scared to come home because you don't know who's going to be there and which personality you're going to get, and you're worried about the kind of example you're setting for your kids, that this could fall under domestic violence and you're entitled to services. And she took them and she got divorced, and she still reaches out to me. She asked me to come
teach
for her brownie troop. And she just, every time she sees me, she's like, I don't think you understand if you had not said that to me. And she's like, it took me a while to let that sink in. So I was like, I'm not a victim of domestic violence. That's not me. I make a lot of money and I have my own job. And when I explained it to her that it was more than just being beaten and that words hurt longer, she stepped out, and her girls like now know what healthy relationships are, and her ex-husband or soon to be ex-husband is getting some help, which is good too. Right.
So sure.
That's really some of the most rewarding, but
I love that.
I'm going to tell you one of the things that I've screwed up for a really long time. So when I was able to start talking about my story, I realized that if I didn't, my ex-husband would continue to win, and so would a lot of other men that feel it's okay, and a lot of women that feel it's okay to abuse people. And so I finally decided that all the pain that I was dealing with, like, I had to kind of turn it into a purpose. And so I started telling my story to people, and I started realizing that there are so many people out there that needed to feel heard and relatable. What I didn't realize, I thought I was the exception when it came to law enforcement, because I still had all this guilt of allowing it to happen. And there's men out there too that now come up to me all the time.
Which you understand is perfectly normal.
I do. I hate it, but I understand that it's not normal.
Okay.
Through a lot of therapy with the greatest doctor I could ever ask for, Dr. Christopher Barker, who I love.
Oh my God, you went into my next thing, so skip that.
Just love him. I'm not going to get into it, but with a lot of work, I've found some really strong moments during that incident with my ex-husband where I realized that I took power away from him and it's why I'm alive. And that's really let me not feel so weak. But I spoke in front of the New Jersey Women in Law Enforcement Conference and I told my story and there's 500 women there. And how ignorant was I to think that I was the exception? When in reality, 1 out of 3 women report being a victim of domestic violence, and that's report. So out of 500 women, I had about 166 women in that audience that had reported it and were probably in this profession because that's their why, to make sure it doesn't happen again. Or maybe they're going through it. And it's hard, especially when your spouse is a cop, because you're worried about him not having, or him or her not having their pension and having to deal with the guns being taken away and worried about whether or not I was going to get blamed and all that, right? Because they know how to manipulate the system. But how ignorant was I to think I was one of the few when I'm not? It's the norm, unfortunately. And I see men being abused too, like threatened that if you leave me, I'm going to pretend that you hit me so I can get your gun taken away. And I see it all the time. So my class is so different than every other street cop class here because it's very vulnerable. It talks a lot about the things that I've been through on a personal and professional level through my entire career. And I add in tactic stuff and I talk about breaking stigmas as women in policing and how we have to take accountability for that as well. But I really, it's a lot of sensitive subject matter. It really talks about gender specific stuff, but not. And I think people come to my class thinking I'm going to teach them how to search a different way, but like, I don't want to insult people's intelligence and their abilities to do that. Like, I know I'm a good cop in every other area, but the impact that I want to have is to let people know that they're not alone and that you can be better. Cause my life is incredible right now. Like I said to you before, I don't even feel like that's me anymore from almost 15 years ago. Like I look back and I'm like, I don't even feel like that. I almost feel like a fraud when I tell this story because I've so far removed myself from it.
That's what I wanted to finish up our talk with.
Yeah.
So that people that are watching in our audience here, because this doesn't just go out to law enforcement.
Right.
This also goes out to everybody, including people that could potentially be victims. For you, and you just touched upon it, I want you to just explain what your thoughts and feelings are with respect to counseling and therapy. And let me, before you answer that, in law enforcement, we provide services to victims in a variety of different ways. Working for a prosecutor's office, my initial would always be the victim witness advocacy. If they were a victim of a sexual assault, when I first started, it was actually called rape crisis.
Yeah.
And it has since changed in Bergen County to something called the healing space. My point being is that we were able to provide services on a quick fix temporary basis for the victim.
Yeah.
But there's also follow up to that because of what emotionally and mentally a victim may encounter. So I wanted to just have you share, because that was the first time you said it. I never heard you say that doctor therapy. I never heard you say that. You never mentioned it. And as somebody in my capacity, I'm always very, very careful about how I bring up topics. And in fact, when people ask me what I do, you know, I don't tell people that I spent many years investigating sexual assault, physical abuse, child sexual assault.
Yeah.
Because if that person who I'm encountering was victimized in some way, it could all of a sudden just trigger. Mm-hmm. So I would say, well, I've worked with children, I've worked with adults, you know, who suffered in some way. And like, that would be just the way I would leave it.
Yeah.
But I want your thoughts on counseling so that the people that are watching who may be hesitant or not feeling.
Yeah.
It's, but just what are your thoughts?
Oh man. Whew. So
anybody ever ask you that one?
Yes.
Okay,
all
good.
The time. So I talk about mental health all the time in all my classes. It's a really big, not a really big portion, but I think resiliency. I know that buzzword kind of gets people aggravated right now because it's getting thrown down thrown in our faces. But I knew I got no services after what happened. You know, we're talking 2008, and so it was still not okay. And now I want to preface this with the fact that Jersey does it a lot better than most other states. And I can say that now from traveling. Like, I believe Indiana doesn't even, their health insurance doesn't cover mental health services, which is absolutely insane to me. But I went to see a therapist, and I told you I grew up in a family that was just very loving and kind. And like, I didn't have any issues, right? Like, whatever you want to call them, daddy, mommy issues, whatever they are. Like, I grew up in a really great home. And thank you, mom and dad. And you actually got to meet my dad yesterday, right? Right. So my dad is just, he's one of my best friends. He's such a good man. My mom is a great, great person too. I went to see a therapist, and one of the first questions he asked was, what happened in your life at home with your parents that allowed you to be in a relationship like this? And I lost my shit. And I was like, this has been really great. And I walked out, and I didn't see a therapist again for a really long time, 'cause I was like, what is this? Like, this is just bullshit. So that was a couple weeks after everything had happened, and I got some breathing room. And then I was on a call of a murder-suicide, which ended up being a domestic because they had dated. And the girl is like laying in the gutter and legitimately, and it's raining on her. And we're obviously not doing anything because we're about to process the body. And the suspect had shot himself. And chief of police right now at the time of Morris Plains is Chief Mike Karosky. He's been a really good friend of mine for a long time. He wasn't the chief yet, and he showed up. I think he was lieutenant at the time. He's standing next to me, and we're just watching because it was right on the border of both of our towns. So the murder happened in Morris Plains. The suicide happened in Morris Township. And he like looks at the body, and he's like, fuck. And I was like, what's up, Mike? And he's like, that's somebody's daughter. That just hit me. And I was like, dude, Mike, that could have been me. And I have no idea where that came from. It just like came out of my mouth. And I turn around and go, so I think I got to go find a therapist because that just kind of hit me in a way. And he's like, yeah, let me know what you need. And I didn't right away, but my kids had been seeing a really great therapist forced by the court system because of things they were going through with their dad. And so I asked her if she had a recommendation. I was like, I can't have somebody who's going to bullshit me. I can't have somebody who's going to like treat me a certain way. I don't need to talk about like this. Like, I know what I need and what I need to talk about. I'm pretty capable with my own mental health. And she introduced me to Dr. Barker, and he is just so phenomenal. But what I tell people when it comes to mental health is it's really okay to be selfish in this manner, and that self-care is not really selfish. Like, people will look at it as that. And you have to be completely honest. Otherwise, you're not really getting any benefit from it. But you have to date a little bit. Like, you would go on a couple first dates with people till you find the person you want to be with. You have to do the same thing with therapists, because not every person is going to connect with you and might not be the right fit. And they have their own baggage, right? Therapists should have therapists. So I have a really good friend that's been going through some stuff, and that person, you know, reached out through the resiliency program and was put in touch with a therapist. And that therapist basically said that they were the problem and just went about it the wrong way. And when I heard about that, I'm like, oh my gosh, you need to go talk to somebody else. And I put that person in touch with my therapist, and instinct like connects, because I know how amazing my therapist is. Like, I just love him. I mean, he was the first person I texted when I found out that my ex-husband killed himself. I'm like, is it okay that I'm happy right now? I mean, I have to go break the news to my kids that their dad is dead. But is it okay that I'm like relieved? Like, am I normal right now? He's like, you are absolutely normal. Like, it's just amazing. And it's so nice to have 1 hour a week where it's just about me and nobody's judging me. And that comes with the right therapist. And what I say to
it actually touches me.
Yeah. When I talk to cops, they think that going for therapy has a lot to do. They're concerned they're going to get their gun taken away because we're not allowed to be humans, right? But on average, on a 20-year average, about 1,200 incidents we see that are critical. Most people only see 2 to 3 in their lifetime, if that, if they're not a cop. We're victims of crimes by seeing what we're seeing. And there's that placebo effect, right, of being in contact with these victims. We're still seeing all of it. Like, we're victimized by our job. Why wouldn't you go do something that's going to help you? And I'm just, before you, in Morris County, we have a critical debriefing team, which I just think is absolutely phenomenal. And it's run by Father Ray. He was like at the Oklahoma City bombing. He's done so many things. And it's all trained officers within Morris County. And it's completely confidential. And the agency brings them out. And a couple different cops will be called in with Father Ray. And you sit around with people in critical incidents. And my squad right now is basically the death squad. We had three major incidents within like a month and a half. And knowing your people is really important. But I was just so honored to be in a room with the men that I work with how vulnerable they were. And to work with a team of officers in Morris County that come out and without judgment lead an opportunity for people to unpack baggage. And they use this scenario that all cops carry around a backpack. And every time you see something traumatic, whether or not you even think it's traumatic, you might just be extra tired or whatever, a rock goes in that backpack. And if you don't talk about it, that backpack's just going to get heavier and heavier and heavier until you can't carry it on your own anymore. So by having the opportunity to be at a critical debriefing, which isn't mandatory, but we get comp time for it. It's usually on our off time. You know, usually some chiefs will get like, let's get you dinner first and whatever. And you're unpacking some of those rocks. Makes it a little easier to survive this job because that's really what this career is surviving it.
I like that and I admire that. And the reason why I asked that question is again, I'm a little thoughtful with what I ask in terms of what I'm trying to extract in information, is because I think it's important that the audience that's watching this, both law enforcement and non-law enforcement, understand that you're a cop, all right? Which means in a lot of people's eyes, tough girl, get over it.
Yeah.
Shit happens, move on. Guess what? Shit happens, but it's not so easy to move on. So if someone like you, who's a cop, and we're taught early on, shut that shit off.
Yeah.
Get past it. That's not the right way.
No.
And that you, as a person, number one, as a mother, a human being, and as a cop, benefited from counseling and therapy.
Oh, yeah. 100%. And I don't really go as much anymore because I've gotten to a point where I've always had the coping strategies, but it was really nice to unload it on somebody else. Like, my husband's fantastic, but he doesn't need that extra layer, right? He worries enough. He's not a cop. He knows what I go through because he does stuff in first responder. You know, and Carolina is my person. If I call her, she's like the best thing you can ever say. And I teach this in my classes. Like Eric, if you called me and you're like, I need to talk to you, the first thing I say to you is, are you looking for advice or are you just looking for me to listen? Because that's really important.
I like that.
Some people don't like want your advice. They just need to unload. And you kind of have to let it be. I think as humans, especially as cops, we are problem solvers and we try to fix everything. And sometimes people don't want to talk to us because they don't want to be fixed. They just want to let it go.
I get that.
Yeah. And so I have really benefited from therapy a lot. And I really do love it. And I think it's important.
It makes me think back to something that my mom used to say to me. And, you know, my entire family is now gone, but it's all good. I mean, I got my three cats. Everything's great. But she used to say to me, what happened to you? I'm like, what are you talking about, mom? You know, like, you know how you are with mothers, and
yeah,
especially as young men and boys. You'd be like, what are you talking about, mom? She's like, you're cold. She's like, you have like ice flowing through your veins and your blood. I'm like, she's like, you know, you what happened? And I'd be like, you know, the simple response was like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. He goes, I'm fine, you know? And deep down, I'm probably realizing, I'm like, yeah, I've seen a lot of bad shit here.
Yeah.
And dead babies.
Yes.
Go to an autopsy of a 6-day-old baby and walk away and be like, wow, look like a doll. You know, I mean, that's what you're thinking in your mind. And then, you know, the over and over and over again. And like I said, I spent many, many years doing these types of investigations. And one thing that bothers me. There's actually, I'll share two things with you that bother me, but I will never do anything about it because it's my choice not to do anything about it. And I live with it. Number one is I can never look at a father with his young daughter playing and not have my mind for a second think, wonder what's going on at home.
Yeah.
That's horrible. That's horrible.
It isn't horrible. It's human.
It's human, but nobody else would think that unless they've seen what I've seen.
Or if they've been a victim of it.
Correct.
Right? So it's not focused on just law enforcement, but yes, I know where you're coming from.
So that bothers me. And the other thing that bothers me, and which I'm left with is that if people talk to me about child sexual abuse, physical abuse, sexual assault, and they may describe something that to any other person would be like mind-boggling, horrific, I have no feelings whatsoever. It does not mean, Heather, that I am not sympathetic, but I've seen so much repeatedly that I'm numb.
So I saw something the other day and it really hit me, and it said, am I strong or am I numb? Right? Because people look at me and the things that I've been through and the story that I tell, and I'm not numb to what I went through. I just don't have to feel it the same way other people do. So I don't think that you don't have feelings towards it, Eric. If I'm ready, here's my psychobabble.
I don't know, but it's fine because I don't share this with anybody, but I'm sharing it with you because you've shared with me and the audience. So I'm sharing two small things in my life that don't come close to what you've endured, but I'm sharing it with you.
I think you're not giving yourself the same grace and patience that you give victims because you...
And I won't.
Yeah, which is, we'll work on that together.
But my new therapist.
Yeah, there you go. I'm free too. I just need a good bottle of bourbon and a cigar. I'm good to go.
Oh, we're together.
How'd you like that cigar yesterday, by the way? It was nice.
I could tell you that I smoke and hit the golf club at the same time. So I was enjoying it very much because I was actually hitting the ball good yesterday.
What I was going to say is, like, you, as somebody who has interviewed a lot of victims, realize that no victim is ever going to respond to any type of experience they've been through the same way. I've had victims laugh, right? And you know better than to judge them based on their reaction and how they come back from it. I think you should allow yourself that same grace and patience, because it's not that you're not feeling it, because the fact that you're bringing it up means it's evoking something, right? It's on your mind. It's something that you deal with. You're having feelings about thinking you don't have feelings.
I had to bring it up. I mean, look. You've shared so much.
I'm glad you did, because so many people think that.
I know, but you've shared so much deep emotions that you've endured in your life, and this is like minimal. I know you.
That is not minimal. Don't minimize anything.
But to me, I wanted to share with you that there was a couple things in my life that, as a result of some things that maybe I've encountered throughout my career, that bother me that I never really did anything about, and I won't.
I mean, this job is really about sacrifice no matter what. I think people come into this career thinking that they're going to be able to be real life superheroes and everybody's going to love them, but we sacrifice so much personally and professionally to get through this career. And I mean, I'm not going to put your business out there, but you said you have three cats. I mean, there's got to be some reason with the things that you've seen why you don't have your own children, why you didn't get married. Right. And, I have friends of mine that do the same thing and won't allow their kids to be at sleepovers. They're remarrying someone for me and wondering whether or not I had good judgment after not having good judgment with my first husband, whether or not he would do something to my kids because they're not his. Like, that's the world we live in, because we understand that that's a reality.
That's true.
But it doesn't make us numb to it. It makes us being able to process it in a way.
And I want our audience to understand that. If you ever meet me in person and you tell me that you have a daughter, I mean, it's not the first thought that comes to my mind. Oh my God, you have a daughter. You must be that's not what I was expressing here. But what I was expressing is that there are times where I can't help but somewhat reflect back to things that I've encountered with parental abuse. And you say to yourself, oh my God, and it's not just men. It could be females physically abusing a child and be like, boy, I hope that child is safe at home. Because when I see a mother yell at their child and I have to just do this. All right. You're not the parent, Eric, and you're not a cop anymore. You know, so if they're going to yell at the child, then, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, gee, I wonder if that child's going to get a beating when they go home. And you can't help yourself.
You know what that's called? PTSD.
We are not discussing that.
We're not going to discuss it, but that's what it is.
Of course.
Yeah, it triggers that kind of stuff. And I'm a big advocate for, you know, just seeking any kind of guidance when it comes to making you the best version of yourself. And if that's a therapist or it's a religious aspect or a really good friend, as long as it isn't something that's self-destructive, I think it's really important to, and I don't think that post-traumatic, people are going to argue with me on this, but I don't think post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder. I think it's an injury that needs to be treated, like
that
physical therapy. You know, like I injured my knees and my hip, like physical therapy to get yourself better. Like, why wouldn't you do that for your head too?
That makes sense. And I think that for us to be able to have this dialogue and this back and forth with each other is something that could be very beneficial to those that are watching. And for you, you've been asked questions repeatedly throughout your life and your career. Many times it would be from strangers.
Yeah.
And this time you're being asked from a friend of what you've encountered. And I wanted to do this. And so the audience knows that we're like, well, maybe we could plan. I says, no planning. Right.
Right.
Says,
yeah.
We're not going to plan. Just, we're going to go off the cuff. And I promise you that I'm going to ask some questions.
Yeah.
You're going to give some answers. And I'm, like I said, I'm not going to make you cry, but
you did. With the whole...
Yeah, but that was just, you know, sharing what I thought was important about what meant a lot to me as a law enforcement officer is not making the biggest arrest possible, but that. And I thought it was so important for you to be able to, in a one-on-one, answer some questions that maybe a lot of the people that took your class wanted to ask you but never did, and what your thoughts were and what you went through. And, you know, I'm so happy that you got to share with me, especially here like this, because these were questions that were on my mind that I was thinking about when I first sat in with your class and wanted to ask you as an interviewer,
yeah,
you know, to get it and for you to be able to share. And you know how much I admire you. I mean, you know that with what you've endured. And my God, Heather, what's the easiest thing to do? Give up, right? I mean, it's easy to give up, but it's not easy to persevere. And I think you're one of those, and I'm not blowing smoke in your ear. You've persevered. I mean,
thank you.
You thought you were dying one day.
Yeah, I thought I was dead.
You were dead. I did. When he had that,
when he had the gun
to your head.
Yeah, I did.
It's not easy to overcome that. So to me, you are beyond a survivor. You persevered.
Thank you.
And look at, you're raising your children. You're remarried. You're happy. You know, I see you every day. When I see you, you know, there's always one thing that's on your face. That.
Yeah. Listen, nothing in life worth having is easy. Unless you're a person that's very, very content with very simple things. I'm just not that person. It would be harder for me to go back to be the person that I was. So becoming who I am now is probably the easiest option I've ever had. And having the right people around you, it's important. And the one thing, I was very anti this whole gender segregation thing back when I started as a cop. And I it's funny now because that's what I teach, right? I teach a gender specific class, but I really do believe that the one thing that women do bring to law enforcement is the ability for men to touch into their vulnerable side and to allow themselves to feel things. So I am now at a point where I'm okay crying in front of my guys on scene, having emotions. Me and my team, we like love each other. Like we love each other. And we hug each other at the beginning of every shift. We say we love each other. You know, we check in on each other. And that's really what this brotherhood is supposed to be about. And I do believe it took me a while to get there in a leadership role, but a lot of it had to come from my vulnerability and a place of, you know, they think that women are too emotional sometimes for this job. And I think that's why we need them in the job. The right women that, you know, are going to be able to let people feel like they're human for feeling certain things. So that's really kind of what I wanted to bring up as far as, I know people always ask about what the difference is between being a female leader and a male leader. And there's nothing, because I work with some very emotional, amazing, emotionally intelligent men. But I just think that's what I brought to the table. I allowed my guys to feel like it was okay to cry without worrying about their gun getting taken away. And I'm sure there's somebody listening to this being like, men shouldn't cry. Well, then you shouldn't be a cop. Whatever. Straight up to your say it to your face. And we can go to the mats if you want to. We can fight about it there.
I love it.
Yeah.
Listen.
Thank you.
You know how I feel about you. You're not just a good person. You're a good cop.
Thank you.
And you're a combination of both. And not everybody could be both.
Thank you.
It's the reality of it. There's some really good cops that are horrible people.
Yeah.
There's some really good people that are horrible cops. So to be both is a blessing, and you're blessed. And I'm happy to be your friend. I'm glad we got to do this today. So I'm going to give you a big hug.
Me too. Street Cop out.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.